Welcome to Sundance 2022 Screen Talk, the very first day of the festival as we record here. I'm Eric Cohn, joined as always by Ann Thompson for our second annual virtual Sundance, hopefully the last one, so we can return to some semblance of normalcy in a year. But I have to say, Ann, as usual, with all of this hybrid and virtual stuff that we've adapted to, we are busier than ever. It's not like just because you're at home, you're not in festival mode. So
I know you and I both have very long queues. We're very lucky. We're very fortunate that we have links and screeners to watch. I've been plowing through mostly documentaries in my case. I think you've probably seen more. So let's start off with the press conference this morning. The Tabitha Jackson, the new head of Sundance, the executive director, Joanna Fazente, made introductory remarks. We know her well. She's been in New York for years as an indie producer, and she was at, I want to say Film Independent, but it was the New York version of
now
it.
Known
Thank you. God forbid I get the wrong name. And she also obviously was at TIFF for a few years there. So and she also experienced, firsthand the challenges of the pandemic at TIFF. So now she's in, landing in the soup again as Sundance had to make a very dramatic and some people think late pivot. The reason people are really upset, I don't know if you have any friends. I have some friends who are going to Sundance because they couldn't get the money back on their condos. So they're going to go ski.
I mean, I've talked to some filmmakers who are there. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what the Sundance scene in Park City is like.
No, they're going to have some fun. I can tell already. There's going to be some condo parties.
I hope not too intensely because it is still a COVID hotspot. But I do think that the late pivot is not up for debate. I mean, it's objectively true that this happened really late in the game. It was decided much later than it was last year. And I feel for the people who had to go through with that, hesitating and so forth. But a lot of people lost money.
But we're not the only company that lost money on this.
No, a lot of people couldn't get refunds and so forth. I did say last week, and I meant it, the people who are complaining they couldn't get refunds on their passes. I mean, ultimately, what you're getting in terms of your money's worth is the opportunity to take advantage of all the same virtual options that everybody else has.
Yes, I'm a little annoyed by the people on Twitter who are sort of like, I got screwed. I didn't get my money back.
Yeah, you paid.
Still watch every movie online.
Your pass is giving you a ton of access, although it is a challenge for some people to figure out the system. You know, even I had some technical problems this week trying to figure things out. But if you force yourself into the mindset of making this virtual festival work through, for some of us, the muscle memory we have of working at a big festival like Sundance, there's a lot that you can do with it on many different levels, from a social level, as well as from exploring the program. So I do think the pivot to virtual while late was the right thing to do, and also very viable because it worked well last year and could work
but
very
they
well.
Had it, they had, whatever the trigger, Tabitha Jackson said was that it was a very difficult thing to do and a very easy thing to do, in the sense that they were prepared for it as soon as the I guess what she was saying was that as soon as the stats told them what they had to do, they did it. But
I don't know. I mean, the stats were pretty bad a few weeks ago too.
I know, that's the thing, and we talked about this last week. There was pressure on them to
Tabitha Jackson does an extraordinary job of speaking to the underlying values of the festival and being this artist first organization, not, really being attuned to the needs of the market. And I think that message, while we dispute some aspects of it sometimes because of the market activity at Sundance, is what keeps it going to some degree. You know, that these films are basically in many situations not going to have a life without some sort of festival platform. And so what they've been able to sustain is some measure of an ability to introduce them to the world, whether that's audiences in 50 states who have passes, or it's buyers or whatever. So Sundance still ends up having an impact through this virtual component, and I don't think they've lost that.
I think it totally is going to have an impact. And there's also the real I often end up here, and it was interesting at the end, you got a question in, Eric.
I always got to ask a question at the press conference. And I have a few of them, actually.
Tabitha
asked one of them.
Yeah, Tabitha basically, you know, defaulted to the, but where I'm going is that in the end, I believe Sundance is a Discovery Film Festival. In the final analysis, right. What are the agents looking for? What are the producers looking for? What are the executives looking for? What are we looking for? We're all looking for that moment of discovery, whether it's Ben Zeitlin's Beasts of the Southern Wild or Ryan Coogler's Fruitvale Station, as she mentioned in answer to your question. And of course, that's the farm team. That's the lifeblood that feeds the rest of the industry. Yeah. No matter how challenging the two-hour narrative movie world is right now, it's going to feed the next Station 11. It's going to feed the next series. It's not just films anymore. It's a whole ecosystem that's still getting fed by Discovery.
And hopefully there is a sincerity to the way it feeds the system, in the sense that you have people who are pretty good at what they're doing and not just filling a particular need, like, oh, hey, I have this IP that's available. How about this director who just had their debut at Sundance? It's more like, oh, this director who had their debut at Sundance already has another script. Maybe these three financiers would like to
exactly
come on
right.
Board.
And
that's
and
really
if people,
the direction it should go.
Exactly. And if people are looking for women directors, which they are very assiduously, this gives them a whole new crop of talent to choose from. And they're going to go out into the world. That's why Sundance is the most important gatekeeper in our industry. It's a huge, huge deal. So tell us about the other thing is that there's, as they talked about, there's social aspects of Sundance. We're not all alone in our living rooms.
So
Erica, share with us the opportunities for Avatar communing on the spaceship.
I'm gonna bring you in this year. You're gonna be.
I need a 3D headset.
No, you don't. That's a great thing. You actually don't for this. Last year that you didn't either. This bespoke platform that Sundance has built through with the New Frontier section. There's a few different environments where you can create an avatar on your computer. As long as you're accredited, all you need is a $25 Explorer pass, and those don't sell out. So this is a pretty accessible opportunity. You can create this little avatar, walk around this area called Film Party, which has different portals that you walk into. Some of those portals go to private gatherings. One of them goes to the New Frontier Gallery, where you can actually access different interactive media. And what I like about it, I mean, I'm obviously like a big proponent of VR as a social gateway to kind of social experience you can't do IRL, because you can be around people who might not be able to get to you anyway. And that's been a big deal during COVID. What I like about this one is that it actually does replicate the Sundance experience of running into people, the organic nature of it. Last year, I walked around with my avatar in this thing called Film Party, which is like a 3D bar, basically. There's a little bar at the center of the room, and anybody can walk up to you. And when they move their avatar up to you, there's a little zoom window where your face is, so you can see the other person and you can hear them, and you have a little bubble where you can talk. And so you can find people that you know and talk to them. But I was approached by people I didn't know, you know, film students from other parts of the country who had never been to Sundance before, who had bought passes and were watching movies. And I think that aspect of it is a huge illustration of what's possible here. And, you know, how you turn that into a business model is a totally different question. But I do think that it captures something that's really cool. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people, when they hear about this, if they're not, you know, interested in video games, or they think it's like something too weird or uncomfortable for them, and they don't give it a try. And I think that lack of open-mindedness is just missing out on a huge piece of the equation, and something really incredible that's been built here that, you know, is.
No, I will. I'll definitely try. I'll go look for you, Eric.
I'll walk you through it.
I don't get enough. No, yeah. So, what have you been able to see any of the actual content though? Sherry Frillo was talking about this dancer doing DIY.
She was Shari Frillo, who programs New Frontier and has for 16 years. You know, it's been this really important new media curator. And she was referring to something called Cosmogony, which is a live dance performance with motion capture dancers. That kind of work is amazing, because in this virtual space, you can watch dancers do things with scale and images as they perform that you wouldn't be able to see them do in real life. There's also a lot of really great VR installation works. There's one that I saw called Dream in My Bones that imagines a world in which your dreams are actually located inside your bones and takes you inside those dreams visually in this
fantastic
really
voyage.
Way. Yeah, the experimental work being done in VR is really mind-blowing and international in scope, but you have to be, you know, in possession of some of the technology to take advantage of it, which is sort of an interesting challenge. But the programming there goes well beyond VR. There's an NFT-based mystery thriller of some sort with AI characters, apparently. I haven't had a chance to fully dig into that yet. But that kind of programming is really cool, I think, because it captures a totally different side of creativity than, you know, the traditional feature-length film. And it is possible to be appreciative of both. You know, they tend to be seen as siloed, like the New Frontier crowd doesn't talk to the feature film crowd necessarily, but the reality is that it's all part of the same kind of impulse. It's just one requires more of a learning curve to understand. So if people do have the opportunity to go into those spaces and they can get to New Frontiers, walk around, because some of that stuff like Cosmogony, which is a live performance, you can see without a headset. So there's some of that curation you can appreciate in that respect. But I will say I've seen a lot of movies too. I didn't forget about that side of the equation.
Yeah, me too. All right, I'm gonna throw out some titles. So we're in a little bit of a situation where we're recording on Thursday. You're gonna hear this on Friday or whenever you do hear it. So we have to respect some of the embargo dates. Eric has seen some of the opening night ones. So I'm gonna just say that there are some docs not to miss. I'm just gonna say check them out. I would say the big titles so far, as far as I've been able to gather, whether I'm telling you I've seen it or not, you know, you can make your own guess.
Wink, wink.
It's Jihad Rehab is definitely worth checking out. I know the four-part We Need to Talk About Cosby is a big title. The Desi and Lucy doc, The Descendant from Margaret Brown. Fire of Love. The word on the street, I can tell you, is about Fire of Love.
Which is an opening night selection and one of the ones I haven't seen. I've seen a bunch of
I can talk about Fire of Love. Okay, yeah. I'm going to tell you, this is amazing because it's this couple of volcanologists and it tracks them through the years who were shooting constantly and taking lots of pictures. They were in love. They were in love partly because they shared an obsession with getting very close to volcanoes. So you're seeing this amazing footage of pulsing, burning, and you see this guy like putting his foot down on a molten coal and watching it explode, you know, and you see things falling near them that could hurt them and kill them. And of course, you know, it's not a spoiler to suggest to you that their obsession killed them, but it is an amazing movie. So you should definitely check that out.
I hope that's not a spoiler.
No, I don't think so. And then the other other one is Downfall, the Rory Kennedy movie about Boeing and what they, how this trusted airplane manufacturer ended up allowing for the deaths of all the people that went up on this remodeled plane.
Well, I gotta see that because we moved to Seattle when I was a kid because my dad worked at Boeing. So my family. That's a Netflix project. Is that right?
Yep. And if you're into, I'm not the target audience for Meet Me in the Bathroom, but folks who love '90s, you know, New York.
Well, early aughts, right? I mean, I remember this era too. It was the Strokes and
Yeah.
That sounds like that would be a fun one.
I go back to the Ramones and Patti Smith.
Yeah. Well, that's that.
Sorry. CBGB's is me.
Well, Please Kill Me was the book that captured that era. And then there was the book Meet Me in the Bathroom, which captured this one and then inspired the doc. So they feel simpatico in a way, just different generation.
All right, give us your opening night suggestions.
Yeah, I've seen a few of them. So
I'm curious about the Jesse Eisenberg, When You Finish Saving the World
movie. So that's, Jesse's directorial debut, which Emma Stone produced as part of her new production company, is really a really charming and sort of surprising character study with Julianne Moore as a woman who works at domestic abuse shelter, and she has this sort of spoiled brat of a son played by Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things who doesn't get along with his mom. He has a fandom online because he's a musician, and he thinks that's all he needs to do to kind of prove himself to the world. And the mother develops this unhealthy fixation on a teenager she's helping at the shelter, to almost like idealize him as the son that, you know, this mother-son relationship that she doesn't have at home. So it's a really surprising kind of story. And it's, you know, I suppose an extension of Eisenberg's worldview of sort of wrestling with issues of privilege and coming from an upper class white background, and what it means to try to have impact within those boundaries when you try to extend beyond them is fascinating to watch. I think it would be a big crowd pleaser, but in person attendance, but the one that would really be the big opening night Eccles film is Emergency. And this is a film from a director named Kerry Williams, who was actually in Sundance Virtual last year with a Screen Life film called RJ. It was Romeo and Juliet sort of through phones and stuff. This is not that at all. This is a pretty big budget Amazon produced comedy about these two Black friends who discover on their college campus before they go out partying that there's a drunk white woman passed out in their apartment, and they don't know what to do about it. They're afraid to call the cops for obvious and unfortunate reasons. And what happens is this sort of dark comedy over the course of one night where they try to figure out, you know, how do they get this woman back to wherever she came from without ruining their lives, ruining their career ambitions. And it sort of has like a super bad quality, but with a more, you know, sort of impactful milieu to it. And the way in which it deals with these very specific race conflicts between younger people is fascinating because it's willing to be funny about them. So that's another one. And then I will say there's a third opening night film in the New Frontier section from director Sam Green, great documentary filmmaker called 32 Sounds. So Sam Green is
a performance piece, right?
Sort of. So last year he had a piece in New Frontier called 7 Sounds, which you could actually do on your phone. It was mostly non-visual. It had a little visual at the beginning, but then mostly you would just listen to him talk about different kinds of sounds and then play them for you. This is 32 Sounds. So it's a sort of presentation of these different sounds with a musical accompaniment and his voiceover. I don't believe he's doing it entirely as a live performance, but there is
he
a way.
He was going to.
Exactly. At the Egyptian, the way they were going to do it was each seat was going to have headphones at it. In the film itself, it starts out by really pressuring you to watch it with headphones because there's a very sonic dimension to it. But it's just a fascinating sort of audio visual immersion, but in feature length format. So no, you don't need a headset or any of that crazy stuff to appreciate what he's done there. So that's another really neat one. But there's stuff all over the festival this year. I mean, the midnight movies that I've seen have been pretty strong. A lot of good first time filmmakers.
There's a lot of genre work. I mean,
a lot of genre work, even outside of midnight.
So we ran a story that our ace reporter, Chris Lindahl, did. There's two, actually. One, he was laying out the 15 sort of big titles for sale, and Call Jane is one of them, the Phyllis Nage movie, or her directorial debut. She directs Elizabeth Banks as a Jane in this fictional drama about a suburban Chicago woman who her consciousness is basically raised through the course of the movie. And I talked to Phyllis because I loved Carol. I loved what she got nominated for, and I was curious because what happens with a situation like that, with a writer like that, who gets basically elevated and recognized for her skills, is that she becomes a piece of talent that everybody's chasing. And so she did the exact thing that I expected, which was to take lots and lots of assignments and collect some income, and then eventually realized that she was going to have to really chase down a project if she wanted to direct. And this is the one that came to her, that spoke to her, and she went for it. So that's one of the titles. And Chris has quite a few more. And then the other story he wrote about today is the idea that the news teams, now that we have streaming at the different studios, a place like Focus, and Peter Kujawski told me this a while ago, they not only get their movies, their nonfiction movies especially, made at Focus, but they can go through Peacock and NBC News. And so Chris talks to NBC executives about some of the buying that's going to go on at Sundance is coming from the news networks. So that's a new wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like now that we're fully within this streaming universe, you know, it's no longer about what's coming. It's about this is just a new normal.
Yeah.
Every entity that is trying to reach the largest number of eyeballs possible is a potential Sundance buyer in some form, which can surprise you. You know, it's only a matter of time before we see social networks buying Sundance movies, right? I mean, it just feels like if you are a powerful brand, you need content in some sort of way that satisfies your agenda. So I like the idea of the, you know, because there are so many docs that could be timely. I mean, you talk about something like Jihad Rehab or something like that, where it's, you know, it's a personal story, but then it also obviously has bigger resonance and it feels newsy, or the Abigail Disney documentary that deals with wage disparity at Disney. I mean, these are things that you're not just talking about a creative object. You're talking about something that can, you know, facilitate conversation about timely subject matters. And so it makes a lot of sense that they would come there with their pocketbooks open in that respect. So I'm fascinated by that. Another sales title that I think will generate conversation, and I'll be curious to see where it lands, is Cha-Cha Real Smooth. That's Cooper Rafe's new film. And what's striking about it is that he's 24 years old, and his first film premiered at the canceled South by Southwest Film Festival when he was 22, and that was Shit House. And they still had their juried competition, and he won the prize. Now he's got, I think, an Amazon series coming in. So this guy's like sort of like when Lena Dunham broke out a few years ago, you're like, how the hell is he doing all this at this age? But it's a pretty big movie with Dakota Johnson and a couple of other notable names. And so I think like any buyer looking for a really accessible movie that can work for a wide array of audiences, they're going to be looking at something like this. That's not to say it's this year's Coda. It doesn't tick off a representational box in the same sort of way, but I do think that's something to look out for. Movies like that, where people are looking at them, they're like, I could totally see how to sell this to people. They don't have to think hard about it. So,
well, the one that looks like it's going to fit right into my Oscar zone, let's put it that way, oriented quality film that might end up in the awards race is Living, which is adapting Ikiru from Kurosawa, and it stars Bill Nye, and I cannot wait. Set in the 50s, and that's one that has my name written all over it. Is there anything else that you're excited to see?
I'm going to be watching things all weekend. I'm excited to see things that aren't even on my radar yet. But I mean, a lot of the ones that you mentioned absolutely are the kinds that I'm definitely going to be angling for. I'll mention
I've got Second Chance on my list, which is Raman Barani's documentary.
That's worth watching. I have seen that.
Yeah. Who sang into the future. It seems to be an irresistible one.
There's a lot of the international stuff that I was trying to figure out how best to answer your question, but a lot of the international stuff, Sundance International program has got much better in the time since I started going to the festival. Mm. I think it's actually become a really good launch pad for films that might be going to Berlin next or other even smaller European festivals. But you know, there are buyers who need international content, but also it's sort of a soft launch for certain kinds of films in a way that might play well to an English language audience, but doesn't spoil their international potential for other festivals and releases and so forth. So I'm really excited to kind of dig deeper into the international lineup. I also have started watching another Netflix documentary. You mentioned the Boeing thing. There's also a Kanye West. It's kind of a mini series, but it's not really a mini series. It's more like a trilogy of features because it's three parts and they're each feature length. It's called Genius. And I've watched the first part. I cannot wait to finish it because the two directors have been shooting Kanye West for over 20 years.
Wow.
The footage starts in 98. And the moment you see it, it's just jarring. And obviously, Kanye has become this divisive figure in just the last few years, even though a lot of people remember what he was like earlier on. Their relationship to his work was much more powerful then. And I think it does, so far, a really good job of reminding you that he is this brilliant artist, before delving deeper into the kind of complexities of his persona. And so I'm excited to finish watching that one. So, Anne, we got to figure out how we're going to hang out. I'll send you some Zoom links to the condo party.
I'm in. I'll see you in 3D, see you at the spaceship.
Exactly. And anybody else who's listening who's doing this stuff, you know, dive in, come find us. It's always fun to interact with people, even if we're not, you know, on the frigid streets of the Park City. So, all right, Anne, let's do this thing. See you soon.
See you later.